A few years ago, I started the process of developing a sitcom. There was a fellow from Tiger Aspect interested, and he was going to pitch it to the BBC. And I started the process of developing, if this sitcom was the road to Manchester United's 1999 Champions League triumph, we didn't get much beyond the birth of Alex Ferguson's great-grandparents. No further, in fact, than me writing the first 10 minutes of episode 1, the Tiger Aspect guy taking it to someone at the BBC, and the someone at the BBC passing on it. The setting was a low-budget Scottish version of SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, with four folk working at a small observatory with a cardboard cutout of William Shatner in the corner. The show was to be called Waiting for Sputnik, and nothing would ever happen. One of those sitcoms. This was several years ago, about 3 years after the Big Bang Theory had started, but at least 4 years before I knew the Big Bang Theory had started, so the idea didn't come out of that. But still, had my sitcom not crashed and burned in the back of the writing not being so great, it certainly would have done when coming face to face with Sheldon. My cardboard cutout Shatner was going to be voiced by the actual William Shatner, which I thought of long after Big Bang was already in its alternative universe where shows get made, getting Leonard Nimoy to voice a Spock toy. Anyway, my main recollection of spending 2 months developing 10 minutes of sitcom script is of arguing over this joke. The first episode opens with three people in the lab. An older chap called Gordon is sleeping at his desk. The other two are chatting, and then one of them, in my head, played by Bill Bailey, gets up to make a cup of tea. He asks Gordon if he wants one. Gordon doesn't reply. He nudges Gordon. Gordon doesn't move. He realises that Gordon isn't just sleeping. He looks around and then says, in a deep Brian Blessed kind of a voice, "Gordon's dead!" After he says, "Gordon's dead," in a perfect sitcom world, Brian Blessed would have been paid 20 quid to come in and voice an echoing, "Dad, dad, dad," in the background. Episode 1 of my sitcom was going to be a dead body episode, which would frankly have been better than episode 1 of Big Bang, which is a guys just want to get laid episode, much like 95% of all other Big Bang episodes. My man from Tiger Aspect didn't get the joke. Okay, it's not, "Yes you did, you invaded Poland," but as sitcom jokes go, it's not terrible, or cheesy, or awkward, or based on embarrassment. In fact, it's based on a guy making a gag as soon as he finds out his work colleague's dead, which I quite like. But the guy from Tiger Aspect didn't get it, and he wanted it removed. I said, "Ask around the office, everyone will get it." He worked on his own in a small office rented out at the BBC's Pacific Quay in Glasgow. He said he went out into the wider BBC office and passed around the gag. No one got the reference, he said. So when I say it took 2 months to develop 10 minutes of sitcom script, which was then summarily rejected by one person and never looked at by anyone else, it was actually 2 months of arguing over the joke based on Brian Blessed's most famous two-word quote. I can't even remember if it stayed in, so it's not like this story goes anywhere. And it's just as well I didn't persevere beyond the BBC rejection, because at some point I would have seen Big Bang and thought, "Oh, there goes that then." Actually, I still think it's a decent idea for sitcom, as long as there were more space jokes than getting laid jokes, and Shatner voicing a cardboard cutout would be innately funny, though that's probably been done before as well. So I named this podcast after the short story collection of mine. There's no particular reason for that other than I like the name and the graphic that goes with it. But in this week's episode, I'll talk about the collection, go through the stories included and read a couple of the shorter ones. The book opens with a story called Aged 8, Alice on the Shore. This came out of reading a piece in The New Yorker about a fellow whose life's work is studying the giant squid. That became coupled with us having a friend who's a mosaicist and my wife being a part-time mosaicist. So this story is a rom-drama about a woman who's making a mosaic of a giant squid. I entered the story in the BBC short story competition. It made the long list. They don't tell you you made the long list until the competition is over and the winner's been announced, which is a bit like finding out your team made the FA Cup semi-final once the season has ended. You don't get to enjoy it in any way whatsoever. All you know is that you didn't win the FA Cup. I wanted to publish this story, but thought it a little short to publish on its own, so dug around for a bunch of other shorts I could stick with it, and this book came into existence. The second story is called Iron Man and features my detective T.I. Westfall. When I signed with Hodder, who published the Westfall novels, they said it would be a good idea to try and get a short story in the Sunday Express. There were two downsides. One, you don't get paid. Two, the story is in the Sunday Express. Now at this point, for both downside one and downside two, every writer on earth should say, "No fucking way." I didn't. I did that thing one does when signing with a new publisher of trying to please them. I wrote this story. The Sunday Express didn't want it, but they wanted me to write something for nothing. I wrote The Elephant at the Table, which is the fifth story in this collection. It was published in The Express some Sunday or other, and I'm sure I sold absolutely no books as a result. I liked the short Westfall story nevertheless, and expanded it a little. Next up is a story called The Tarantino Version. It's about a teacher whose wife is having an affair. I took the title from The Browning Version. I originally wrote this in 1996 as an 80,000 word book that no one wanted to publish. It works better as a short story. I'd read this one, but the central character is influenced by Pulp Fiction, and I'd have to read my guy doing Samuel L. Jackson, and no one wants that. Next up is another rom jam called One More Cup of Coffee. It's about old nautical compasses. I like old nautical stuff. At some point I made the couple at the centre of the romance Dylan fans and gave the story its title. Something else Hodder asked me to do for nothing was write another Westfall short story they could use to lure people onto a newsletter list or something. I can't remember exactly the plan, but basically it was, can you do something for nothing? And I said yes, because I'm too nice and very exploitable. I doubt it attracted many people to the newsletter list they set up for me, but I quite like it nevertheless. It's called Touch of the Spider. Next up is a very, very short story. A long time ago, the first time I appeared at celebrated crime fiction festival Crime Fest in Bristol, the panel moderator, Donna Moore, asked us panellists to write a very, very short story. I wasn't to know at the time that it would become the best thing I would ever write. The Ringmaster. Then we have Flying Birds, another rom dram, set in Findhorn on the Murray coast during geese season. That's all. Then there's The Artist, another slightly silly, short story. History does not recall why I wrote this, but it exists and it's included here. The penultimate tale is called The Case of the Stained Glass Widow, which features DCI Jericho, another of my miserable middle-aged detectives. This was written about 10 years ago when the digital publisher Blasted Heath had started up and they were looking for their authors to write shorts that could be published as 99p books on Kindle. I'm not a huge fan of it, to be honest, but here it is, as balance against all the rom-dram. Finally, some more little bit magical rom-dram, Cold September and There's Reason to Believe. Based on travel documentaries where the well-known host of the show turns up at a thing where people have been doing their life's work, and the story then becomes about the well-known TV host now doing the thing and not about the people whose life's work it is, and they become background characters next to the guy off the telly. The title comes from the first line of the Counting Crows song, Long December, which was in my head at the time, though the story has absolutely nothing to do with the Counting Crows song, Long December. I'll read two of the stories. Firstly, the brief but magnificent The Ringmaster, followed by the slightly longer and significantly less magnificent The Artist. The Ringmaster. No one ever knew his real name. They called him The Ringmaster. Now he was dead, his body crushed and battered and broken in an attack that was bestial in its ferocity. His killer, in a final act of diabolical brutality, had slit open his stomach, sucked up his innards and then sprayed them around in a bloody 50-yard radius. The lungs, somehow containing the last vestiges of air, bounced into a far corner. The heart rolled over beside them, leaving a trail of aortic slime in its wake. It was nasty, but it was the Glasgow way. When the deed was done, years of humiliation having been avenged, his killer returned to her small caravan, where her clothes and all her possessions were neatly laid out in the bed, ready to go. And so it was that at 4:37 on a June morning that had already dawned warm and bright, Nelly the elephant packed her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. The Artist. It had been 25 years since the movie opposite Bruce Willis. His screen time hadn't been great, but he'd been the perfect villain. Then he'd taken the role with Bobby De Niro that the critics had admired but which no one had watched, following which he jumped at the part in the Mel Gibson film, just as people had stopped going to see Mel Gibson. From then on, the slide had been precipitous, every step he took seemingly the wrong one. Having failed to get the part of Snape in Harry Potter, he had stupidly followed his agent's advice and refused to accept a lesser role. When he'd returned to the producers a few years later, crawling and desperate behind a new agent, he hadn't even been given an audition for the role of Slughorn. All right, can we have some quiet, please? Shouted the assistant director. The noise died away. Someone laughed loudly, then cut it short. The low hum of filmmakers at work settled over the production, such as it was. There had been some television work in Channel 4, and of course a regular place in Casualty whenever they'd wanted it. But he loved film. He needed to be in film. He wanted his Hollywood star, and he wasn't going to get that, playing an ageing, racist, homosexual Polish doctor on BBC One at 8 p.m. on a Saturday. Not that he was likely to get it here, either. OK, let's keep it together, people, said the AD, his voice quieter now. Scene 12, take one. As far as anyone knew, the director was currently engaged with the best boy in one of the three caravans parked outside the old manor house. The large wooden door opened. A young woman entered. She immediately gasped, her hand going to her mouth in affected surprise. Like, Marvin, what are you doing? That's like totally gross. The other young woman looked up from the bed. Bliss, help me, she panted. Marvin isn't a priest. He's a vampire zombie. He's not even from this planet. Bliss looked curiously at Marvin, who was leaning over the half-naked Summer, about to plunge his fangs into her breasts. Really? Said Bliss. That's like so weird. A vampire zombie. Do I even know what that is? The vampire zombie turned malice in his eyes. The same look of evil disdain with which he had once held sway over Bruce Willis. I am centuries old, he said. I was born before time itself. I walk with the dead. Angels and demons are my companions. He hesitated. The AD sat forward. One take per scene was pretty much all they could afford. He began again. But this time George stopped quickly, turned away from the naked breasts and straightened up. Cut, shouted the AD. He breathed heavily, counting to five. What is it, George? This, said George, turning his back on the young woman who still lay naked in the bed, not feeling it necessary to cover herself. This is absurd. The AD held his gaze but did not speak. Bliss is right, said George, indicating Bliss with a nod without actually looking at her. Like, duh, said Bliss. Do any of us actually know what a vampire zombie even is? Said George. Can you do the scene, please, George? How can I possibly speak to my audience? Your audience wants to see you suck blood from that girl's tits. End of. Will you just do it? George turned away from the AD, albeit not in the direction of the tits, and tossed a theatrical hand in the air. The vampire is a sophisticate. His way is subtle and intelligent. Guile and sophistry are his companions. But not the zombie. The zombie is quite the opposite. Base and ignoble, brutish, driven by a slavish lust for flesh. With the exception of the blessed Colin Firth, is there an actor among us who could reconcile the two? The AD scratched his ear and leaned forward. George, this isn't Pericles' Vampire Zombie of Tyre, or I don't know, the Merry Vampire Zombies of Windsor. It's a low-budget horror porn slasher noir screwball comedy. Our audience doesn't want sophistry. Our audience thinks sophistry is the art of arranging cushions. George straightened his shoulders. He started this argument many times in his head, and now here he was at last in its midst. Time to engage. I get letters from my fans. Letters, not emails or tweets. My fans are people of quality, and they tell me that what they look for in my films is a certain finesse that urbanity and savoir-faire one so rarely sees these days. The AD was still scratching his ear. He sucked his lips for a second, then indicated with his hand for Bobby, the unpaid script editor who was hanging around the set, learning the ropes to come over. He jogged up, glad to have something to do. A moment of excited fear, wondering if the AD was going to request a last-second dialogue audition. Bobby, said the AD, can you remind George of the title of the film we're making here today? Having in the space of 3 seconds decided he was about to be asked to contribute some hastily written dialogue for the RSC-trained thespian star of the film, Bobby was momentarily discombobulated. Everyone knew the name of the movie. The AD prompted him with a pair of raised eyebrows. Butt-naked alien vampire zombies go Jesus, said Bobby. Thanks, Bob, said the AD, ushering him away with the reverse of the gesture with which he'd brought him forward. Bobby retreated, the sudden burst of adrenaline having evaporated, returning wearily to his spot in the sidelines. The AD looked back at George. Butt-naked alien vampire zombies go Jesus, he said. A title which seems to date from the Renaissance itself, doesn't it? When George conducted these arguments in his head, he was never greeted by sarcasm. I think, in fact, the writer maybe even borrowed the name from a Donatello sculpture. Am I right? The AD added, looking around the small movie crew. There were a few laughs, although one or two of them came reluctantly. George might have been something of a pompous oaf, but he was likeable enough, and had interesting stories to tell of the world of big studio movies to which they all aspired. Nevertheless, George, said the AD, having gloried in his small moment of mocking triumph, I'd be very grateful if you could do me the favour, on this occasion, of just biting the girl's tits on camera, as written in the script, which you read before signing up to do the movie. They held the gaze across the short distance of the large bedroom. 18th century wood panelling on the walls, furnishing picked up from Free Cycle 2 days earlier, rented film equipment due to be returned the day after tomorrow. Or do we need to have a chat with legal? George had heard that line before. George had heard that line from directors and producers who actually had a legal department to call upon. If this lot had a legal, it would likely be someone's cousin who was in the first sheet of law at Southampton. George finally lowered his eyes, looking down from the lofty height of his straightened shoulders, and slowly the air left his chest. The fight faded away. You know, said Bliss, I think my character should be more tangential. No one reacted. Like, a lot more tangential. That evening, George retired alone to his dingy little hotel room somewhere in the heart of old Somersetshire. The young lady whose breasts he'd feasted upon earlier in the day once more offered her breasts, this time in a more intimate setting, but he politely refused. The following morning, George did not come down for breakfast.